We'll continue our According to Mark study tonight. We're finally up to chapter 10. Hopefully we'll finish this sometime. But Mark chapter 10, which is a chapter that is very much continuing Jesus' teaching on discipleship in a variety of ways and how that discipleship plays out. The interesting thing here in Mark is very similar, the way it's set up here, it's very similar to what you might think as a catechism. It's predominantly teaching material, but set up kind of like a catechism where the church might use it for teaching and for reminding them of family rules, rules of conduct, that kind of thing. In fact, it's very much like life and family rules of conduct for different groups of people, and represents as Edward Schweizer says, it is the kind, and it starts off with the kind of controversies in which the church was frequently engaged, such as in its quarrel with Judaism, end of quote. So a lot of the teaching in here involves things that are controversial as the church faces Judaism and other questions that might be raised. Now, some question how much this comes from the historical Jesus, but in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, especially this first part dealing with divorce, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 10, Paul writes about a word from the Lord concerning this kind of situation. So this is a teaching that had come from Jesus and had been passed down. But we also have to, when we get down here, verse 12 is something that would be speaking predominantly to the Gentile relationship. It speaks to Jewish relationships, but Gentile relationships in particular, because in Judaism there would not have been the relationship where a woman could divorce her husband. And that's mentioned here in this chapter as well, as Jesus teaches. So we begin here. And he left there and went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan, and the crowds gathered to him again. And again, as his custom was, he taught them. In this particular instance, after Mark chapter 8, with Peter's confession and then the healing of the epileptic boy and moving along with other teachings, Jesus, this is the equivalent of Luke chapter 9, verse 50, where he said, where it says, verse 50, 51, where it says, and he set his face to go to Jerusalem. That means Jesus has consciously made this decision, this turning point. It's now time to go to Jerusalem to face the passion. And so this is Mark's equivalent of that when he says, and he left there and went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan. Jesus, in this particular instance, is on his way. In fact, when we get to chapter 11, we find this secret Messiah. You know, remember the messianic secret here. We find this secret Messiah arriving in Jerusalem. And chapters 11 to the end of the book of Mark, chapter 16, verse 8. Where it ends in the oldest manuscripts, that is in Jerusalem, around Jerusalem, those last few months, or last actually month or two in Jesus' earthly life leading up to the crucifixion, resurrection. Now, so Jesus heads southward deliberately towards suffering and death. And once again, it's also interesting to note that Mark places this immediately after Jesus has made another prediction of the passion. His suffering and death. So, you know, the mention here that Jesus taught them, that is the people, as he always did, also reminds us that even though we may misunderstand it, like the disciples do. Remember we said in Mark the disciples are pretty dense. They have a lot of duh moments. We need to remember that sometimes we misunderstand as well, and we need to continually be teaching and be taught as we study these kinds of things. And so, he teaches them, and Pharisees in the crowd, remember at this point especially, there are Pharisees that follow Jesus around. Sadducees, not so much, because they're the guys that are in charge of the temple. The Pharisees go out and they collect this information, then they come back to the Sanhedrin, made up of Sadducees and Pharisees, but they go out at the behest of the Sadducees. High priest was always a Sadducee at this point in time. So the Pharisees came up, and in order to test him, ask him a question concerning the law and other things. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? He answered them, what did Moses command you? And they said, Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and to put her away. But Jesus said to them, for your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. So the initial question here, the Pharisees are trying to get him actually to go against the law, to say something against the law. Remember, it was not called the law of God, by the way. They referred to it as the law of Moses and of God. Whenever they referred to Torah, they would say, it's the law of Moses and of God. Because a lot of stuff had been added to that as well, even in the time of Moses. And so the Pharisees come in here, and the real dispute is centered on what could be considered divorceable action. Note here that the Pharisees twice refer to permission. Moses says, we got permission to do this. That is, allowance to divorce. But Jesus refers twice to the command which is God's desire, that a man and a woman be husband and wife forever. The Pharisees were concerned with their rights. Jesus was concerned with people looking at what God's idea and ideal was. Schweizer writes, and I quote, when a person begins to ask this kind of question, he is seeking the greatest possible advantage for himself within the limits of what's permissible. In so doing, he will have destroyed the marriage even before it happens. End of quote. You know, if you're already looking for a way to get out of it, or thinking, well, we'll go into it, but hey, if it doesn't work out, we can always get rid of it. So you've already destroyed the whole idea of marriage. Yeah. If you go into it looking for it, you've destroyed the idea of marriage already. Okay? And so he writes here, yes? Well, it's the Pharisees, and one, there were probably some of them that were, because actually there were points in time where the law got twisted to the point to where, I mean, a man could divorce his wife for whatever reason, burns breakfast or, you know, or he sees somebody that he desires even more, and he could come up with an excuse to divorce and therefore be married to all kinds of women through his lifetime. That's for themselves. That's doing their stuff, not what God would prefer. Yes, Susan.
Well, was this at a time when there were many wives?
Yeah,
not within Judaism. Well, Abraham had Sarah, but he had others. David, of course, had wives. Solomon was not wise. People say Solomon was wise. Solomon was not wise with 1,000 women. Right. It was not what God desired. It was what the culture and the custom said could happen.
Well, what about the 12 tribes?
The 12 tribes of Israel? And the same thing too. You've got,
Rachel and Leah.
Yeah, Rachel and Leah.
They were,
but the question is that what God wanted or what was allowed? And there's a difference in God's desire and what is allowed. At this particular point in time, you've got people that still in Judaism that would see, okay, well, I see somebody out here that's much more desirable, but I can't have multiple wives, especially as a religious leader. I can't have multiple wives, but if I find an excuse to divorce this one, then I can go out and marry that one. Right. But once again,
after he was let go and gone up, go to Zoar or wherever he went, his daughters took him and had babies by him.
Right. Well, that's what their decision. See, that which reminds us, which is another reason that I say I argue with people in a lot of different ways. Excuse me. I discuss with people in a lot of ways, and sometimes I argue with them when they push predestination. That's free choice. They chose to do that rather than God saying, hey, go out and do this. And that's the same thing with these multiple wives. They chose with a cultural kind of thing to do that. Well, it's just like Abraham. Abraham had Sarah. Sarah couldn't have children. The custom said, not what God said. Notice the covenant child is the one between Sarah and Abram, not between Abram and Hagar.
Didn't some of this kind of stuff start when the husband was either killed off or deceived?
Well, the Levirate marriage. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Well, within Levirate marriage, there was that idea that if a man died, a man was married, he died, and he didn't have any heirs, that his brother then would take that wife and have heirs for him. But once again, that was something that was more of a cultural, social kind of thing done by the folks. In part, quite frankly, once the land was divided into tribes and the tribes got this land here, if a woman is married and the husband dies and she marries somebody from another tribe, guess what? He's got a piece of the pie over here. And so part of the Levirate marriage was actually to make sure that it stayed in the family rather than getting out here in other places. Now, that is a social and cultural kind of thing. That is not to say that that's not what God determined. But, you know, then again, God will let us run with the leash for a while. You know, that kind of thing. We make those choices.
But also the Bible, you know, David took Bathsheba.
That's right. And the child suffered. Now, some people say that he did. He uncovered him, but that doesn't mean that he had that. Right. Well. Yeah. But that does. Yeah. But that. Yeah. They could have been in Congress. Or Hollywood.
I don't think
we have a perfect. No, but see, that's one of the things. That doesn't mean that God approved that, and that God and noticed people suffered. But that says, yeah. But that's what that shows is. And see, one of the things that people, the Bible doesn't sugarcoat. The Bible, warts and all, it's out there. It's you know, and which then says, oh well, those people, they were so horrible. And you look around, and it's like, you know, it's relevant today too. So the Bible doesn't sugarcoat, but there's a difference in what God desires and what God lets us do. And so these are choices that are made. And just like Moses allowed a man to divorce his wife, and Jesus said, "Well, you know, that's cause you're too stubborn and hard of heart. You're too dense. You don't learn fast enough." So you know Moses allowed it, but that doesn't mean that. That's what God ordained. Yes?
God's general will and his specific will, too, he allows stuff. There's stuff he wants, but he does allow stuff.
Well, there's stuff that is God's desire for us, but God allows us to have the choice to do that or not. So people divide, well, God's got this will and that will and permissive will and those kinds of things. I think that's splitting hairs too much, quite frankly. I think there's what God's desire. And see, I like to use the word desire as opposed to will, because will says that you're going to do this. Whereas desire says, this is what I want for you. But you've got the freedom to choose to follow it or not. And so, you know, this would be, I think, in that realm where God says, this is what I desire of you. A man, and notice, it wasn't the woman leaving her family to be in a man's family. It's a man gives up that, all of that security. And that's what it's about, is he gives up the security of family right there in order to be with this person, and two shall become one. The ideal for God is a man and a woman forever. But not all marriages can be that way. And so, you know, when we get to Corinthians, Paul even goes and says, now I say to you, not the Lord, but I say, it's possible that ultimately divorce may be the ideal is still, given that situation where you've got people from maybe the cult of Dionysus or Orpheus or something like that, or one of the other Greek mystery religions, and both the husband and wife are that, and then one of them converts to Christianity, and the other one doesn't, and they say, well, we might as well jettison all of this, right? And as long as they'll live under the Christian the Christian principles and agree to that, no, the ideal is still to stay together. But if it becomes a war zone, God calls us to peace, or other things happen, then there is the possibility. Now, Matthew adds to this story, except for unchastity. Mark doesn't have that in here. Matthew adds that later in his account. But, I mean, it's a good question. But I think a lot of times what we do in talking about God's perfect will and God's permissive will and this will of God is we end up splitting hairs that are unnecessary. And that and a dollar gets you drink machine, less dollars are more expensive. Drinks are more expensive. Dollars aren't more expensive. Or maybe they are. And so here we've got, they're trying to get Jesus to contradict the law of Moses and the biblical teachings. And, you know, Jesus said, for your hardness of heart, he wrote this command. He did this, he wrote this command down, because you guys are too duh. You're too dense and you're hard of heart. You want things for you, not looking for what God's desire and God's hope for you is. You know, so you're seeking the greatest possible advantage for you, not what God would have you do. He said, from the beginning, God's desire is this. God didn't give a different way. This was God's desire. That's why I like to use desire rather than will. Because will also can mean desire, but when we think will, you're either thinking of the last will and testament, or you're thinking this is my will and I'm going to impose it. Kind of thing. So God's desire is this, but you know, people do things differently. We also find here the understanding that God ordained the two sexes, male and female, and gives marriage through that nature. And he says, because of this, or for this reason, a man will leave the protection of his clan. That's what it means, a man will leave his father and mother. The protection of his clan. He has to choose to step out and take a chance. I'm not going to sing an ABBA, take a chance on me. But he steps out to take a chance with this person. The two then become one. They're taking a chance because the wife is coming out of her family's protection. The man is stepping away from his clan's protection, and together they are making something. As I say, oftentimes when I do weddings and we'll have, you know, the bride and the groom declare their intent, and I'll say, okay, families, will you accept them as into your families as they make a family of their own? I still remember one, and it's some good friends' son's marriage, and I still remember that everybody in that family said, we will, except for the older sister of the bride. I watched her. There was some friction between she and the groom, and I watched her. I looked like this, and she went in front of God and everybody. So,
but isn't it true in the spiritual realm, there's no gender?
Well, in Christ, there is not to be the distinction of gender. Within Judaism, if you were a woman, how did you become a child of Abraham? By being the daughter of a circumcised Jew or the wife of a circumcised Jew. You didn't get that status on your own.
They were not always circumcised.
No. They were supposed to be, or they could be cut off from being the people. Not early, no. It's only after Abraham with a circumcision. But before that, they were not. But if you refused to circumcise your sons, you were cut off from the people of Abraham.
Well,
the covenant. You were cut off from that. If you didn't circumcise your servants.
But we don't have that covenant anymore.
Right? The Old Testament is the foundation.
The Gentiles didn't have it.
The Gentiles did not have that covenant to begin with.
But
if they became a proselyte, a convert to Judaism, then they agreed to that. That's why I tell folks a lot of times you had to make awfully sure that's what you wanted to do. Because you could be 30 years old and you had to submit circumcision. Right. A requirement. Right. But the point here is monogamy, not polygamy. Monogamy, not polygamy. Or not divorcing just because you decide a more desirable woman has come along. they're serious things. You know, the marriage is serious. And as I say many times, I think, and I tell couples when I counsel with them, we need to put a sign over the door when people come into a wedding says for adults only. Because too many people don't approach it as adults. They approach marriage as we're going to play house. And the desire from God is that you be. Though there are instances where divorce may be the only option. And yet Paul indicates that there may be a possibility, a strong possibility, or I would think a probability, that given the circumstances and all, that the Christian brother or sister is no longer bound not only to that marriage, but against any remarriage to another Christian. Not go out and marry another pagan, no. Or non-Christian, no. But to another Christian. Marriage is based upon the fact of creation, God's creation of people. They're no longer two but one flesh, and what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. That's still God's desire. What God joins together, you don't split up. The thing is, though, oftentimes we do. But that's our choice for whatever reason, whatever circumstances come about. But, as I have often said too, and will say again, divorce is not the unpardonable sin.
Well, you know, when I was growing up in church, if somebody was divorced, they couldn't hold an office. They couldn't be a deacon.
Well, and there's still churches that are like that, but.
But yet, I don't think God looked at it that way.
No, I don't think so either. You know, there's forgiveness and other things. Divorce is not the unpardonable sin. What's irritated me for a lot of my adult life is we will, used to have the sawdust trails and Billy Graham and all these others have come around with the Kentucky Fried Chicken buckets and that kind of thing. Somebody could murder somebody. They could kill somebody, spend time in prison. They get a come-to-Jesus moment, and they get out of prison for good behavior. And then what will we do? We not only let them teach a Sunday school class, we'll stick them out there on the evangelistic road and let them give the testimony and collect all kinds of money. But somebody has a marriage that doesn't go right, and perhaps they've done everything they can to try and keep it together, and it still doesn't go. And a lot of churches would not, and there are some even today, they won't even let them teach a Sunday school class, much less. That's not the unpardonable sin. And which one of us has not done something sinful that could keep us out if people really wanted to? But once again, that's a man-made thing to keep them from doing that. That's true. Well, they do. Who defines that?
I don't know.
I mean, who defines that?
It's hard to know.
A well-placed hand on the bottom. That worked wonders with my sons. My mother made us, as I told you, my mother made us cut our own switch, and if we didn't cut one that she liked, she'd go watch us cut one. But, yeah. Yeah, I mean, what's abuse? But, you know, here he's talking about, you know, Jesus calls the people to remember one of God's greatest gifts and to seek to live on that basis. One of God's greatest gifts. He's not pushing legalism, which is what the Pharisees were trying to do. They had legalism. And what they were saying is, we got permission through this legal system to do this from Moses. Now, what do you say? And Jesus said, I'm not going to go to legalism. There is life outside of legalism, and it's more meaningful. And unfortunately, it's hard, and yet it's life that can be seen with grace. So we still have the choice whether to accept God or not, whether to follow God or not. You know, God's desire for us. And then, typical in Mark, Jesus then takes the disciples aside and begins teaching them. They go into the house, and he begins teaching them separately about this. To continue to teach the disciples. And even here, they don't understand. In the house, the disciples asked him again about this matter. He said, wait a minute, we don't understand. What do you mean by this? And this, once again, is where Mark continually shows the disciples to be dense. It's right there in front of them, but they don't understand. In part because they're not looking deeply enough. They're trying to see things from their perspective rather than from the perspective of Jesus. And he says, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. And what he's talking about here is if it's wanton, Not if there is a significant issue that warrants it. It's just wanton divorce.
But it doesn't say that.
No, but that's...
That sounds like an interpretation to me.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
But I also...
Huh. There are reasons for divorce. I'm not arguing that. But to say wanton, you're inserting that interpretation. It doesn't say wanton.
No. But I'm seeing it in the context of Jesus' teaching and Jesus' ministry. Is that, you know, there is forgiveness. What did he say to the woman who committed an act of adultery? Don't do it again.
Yeah, don't do it. He didn't say you're sinless.
No, but he forgave her.
He told everybody else.
Yeah. But he forgave her of her sins.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real sticky wicket.
It is. And the legalism that comes out of that verse.
Yeah, because that verse basically says if you divorce someone and marry somebody that's an adulterer, that's what it says.
Of course, Jesus in Matthew says, save for unchastity. So there's a condition put on it there. So, you know, Mark, of course, is the oldest gospel and the shorter.
Just having sex with somebody else?
Unchastity is not being faithful to your spouse with someone else. With someone else, yes.
It doesn't necessarily mean a physical relationship.
Unfaithful to the spouse. Now, they would have seen it, unchastity, as a physical relationship.
But
even there, Jesus puts a condition.
But a man can commit adultery and a woman can, but they stoned the woman. Why didn't they stone the man?
Male-dominant society. Code of Hammurabi. Yeah, well, the code of Hammurabi.
Yeah,
code of Hammurabi was very progressive. In the code of Hammurabi, Ariel, if there was adultery, because it takes more than one, if they brought only the woman, she wasn't punished unless a man was there too. Code of Hammurabi, the Babylonian king, 17th century BCE. Yeah, so you know that was a very progressive kind of thing. Right. Well, he's both. He's both. But once again, that's not God's will. Those are David's choices. And the son, and I tell you, when everybody said, oh, look, isn't he so wonderful, this woman, her husband died in service for him and he married her and isn't that great? And then she starts showing and, oh, isn't that great? He didn't want her to feel like she was left out because of these women. And there's some little blue haired old lady in the back saying, let's see now when. But, and where I come down with what I said a while ago about wanton divorce is within the context of Matthew's statement where Jesus said, save for unchastity. He puts a condition on it.
I mean, we, in our society today, this is not part of what we believe.
No.
I think most churches don't do that. I think most churches don't practice that philosophy about divorce. I really don't.
Well, I know of a lot of churches that do. And generally don't, but within Baptist, within some Pentecostal, within other free church traditions, there are those pockets that still do.
But if you had to put like percentage wise,
Norwood Oak Grove.
Who I would marry and who I wouldn't marry. And sought counsel from a lot of wiser people than I am. And that's a hard, hard subject. From what I've come across from different people I've spoke with, I personally feel like if I walked away from my wife today and married someone else, I commit adultery. I think Scripture is clear. I believe without a doubt I would not marry a saved person and a lost person. Perform that wedding. Someone that's married, got a divorce, and wants to marry someone else. That is hard for me to reconcile in my mind, would I perform that wedding? Because by the scripture you're reading, where I'm allowing this marriage to take place by my authority, given by God, that they come together and I'm putting my stamp of approval on it and saying, okay, but the way the scripture reads, that she would be committing adultery. If there was, like you said, the only, you know, adultery, chastity, you know, not having sexual immorality, you know, those kind of things would limit you from that marriage. Your marriage would be dissolved, in my reading. It would be to where you're not held accountable for that.
And there are a number of folks there. I also look to, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where Paul is talking about, you know, Christians should stay together and live under that if at all possible. And then the question that comes up there in chapter 7, where the question, of course, he deals with celibacy, which he says you ought to be celibate rather than get married. But, and you know, as a concession, if you're going to burn with passion, then go ahead and get married. And that doesn't sound like much of a reason to get married, especially when in the first letter he writes, 1 Thessalonians, he said you should know how to choose a wife in honor and holiness, not in lust like the pagans. So wait a minute, you're saying if you lust and you can't, then you ought to get married? You know, so they're situational letters written to particular situations. But where he deals with that, you know, he said, and the question that comes up about, as I said a moment ago, one who is Christian, one who is not, and they say, wait a minute, that's being unequally yoked. Shouldn't we split up? And he says, no. The ideal is still to stay together, if at all possible, and if they will agree to live under those principles, for who knows, you might help the redemption of your spouse either way. And besides that, your children are considered holy, which is another issue out there, but, you know, in a discussion. But then he says, but if the unbelieving partner desires to separate, and the particular word there is an overwhelming desire, that's all they want to do is get out of it, then let it be so, for God, and by that, the Christian brother or sister is no longer bound, for God has called us to peace. There are many who see that concession as, if the marriage becomes a war zone and it becomes dangerous, then that may be the only action. And not only are you, and different churches interpret it differently, that particular marriage are you not bound to, but there's no prohibition against marrying someone who might be a Christian. Example. Church that I was in as Minister of Education before coming here in North Carolina, Hope Memorial Baptist. We were looking for a pastor before I came to South Carolina to teach. And went through a lot of different things. And finally, the pulpit committee, pastor search committee, brought a candidate to the church. A candidate who had been divorced and remarried, and he and his wife both were pursuing Master of Divinity degrees at Southeastern. In fact, he had just finished and Martha Lou was finishing up. And they checked out his story. He told them the story. They checked it out. The church listened, etc., to the story and then made the decisions after some consultation, a lot of prayer. When Tom and his wife graduated, they were high school sweethearts. They got married within weeks after graduating from high school. He wasn't sure what he wanted to do, didn't want to go to college. She wasn't going to college. He went into the military, and he decided to become a corpsman, medic, corpsman. They were married for a while, and he had a lot of training going on, and he was gone, and would be back, and was gone for periods of time, would be back. She got lonely, decided to start issuing invitations to other people to come stay with her when he was gone. When he found out, he got to talking with her, and he did all kinds of things to try and, okay, what do we need to do? And she eventually said, once again, people can be dense, but that's okay. Sometimes I have been. She said she was so lonely, and also they decided they'd take care of her loneliness. The way to keep her busy and get rid of her loneliness, let's have a baby. And so they did, and they had a son. He came home one day from work with the military when their son was about 6 months old, found the baby asleep in the crib and a note beside of him. She had run off with another guy who was in the Army, and would be back that evening to collect the child and his things. Now, of course, back then, the mama sued, the mama got the baby. And especially with him being gone a lot. So she ended up, he tried to keep it together, keep them together. No, no, no. She took the baby, she ran off, all kinds of things. Eventually, when the child was about 8 years old, Tom's parents asked for custody, and they were granted it because this woman had, Tom's the only one she'd ever been married to, and she had already lived with two other guys after that. Now, the last time I heard, or Tom heard anything that I know of, it's probably been 15 years ago, and she had been with five guys, but he's the only one she was ever married to. He tried and tried and tried to get her to counseling. They went for about a month, and then she stopped again. Nope, don't want to have any part of this. In the meantime, he felt led to go to college, and he went to Campbell and felt led to get a religion degree and then to go to seminary. He did all of that kind of stuff. You know, they were divorced because of all this, and she overwhelmingly desired and then some. While he was at seminary, he met Martha Lou, who was in seminary in a Master Divinity program. And they started dating, and they went through a lot of counseling and talking with professors and counselors and all that kind of stuff. And all of those eventually, after checking out, you know, listening to the story and what all happened, came back to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and said, in our understanding here, there's grace offering. You're not bound to this marriage, nor are you prohibited from marrying this Christian woman here. So, Pastor Search Committee checked that story out, talked to a lot of different people, found out it was true. They came recommending, but they also talked to the church about it and said, here's what it is. Y'all need to talk about it. We'll have discussions. They asked me what I thought, and I said, I don't see any reason they shouldn't be married, nor that we shouldn't call him. The day that he did his trial sermon, he also shared that story before the church. And when they voted, although I tried, I'm always nervous when you vote the same day. I know it's happened when I've been, it happened when I came here. I like for people to have a week to think about it and talk about it. But the vote was like 135 or 40 to 2. We called him. I was there for a couple more years before coming here to teach. There were, in that church, there were approximately 15 to 20 divorced or divorced and remarried couples that rarely came to church. They were almost Christers, Christmas and Easter only. But they, some, many of them had grown up in the church and that kind of stuff. By the time I left 2 years later, almost every one of them were there just about every time the doors were open. Some of them taught Sunday school. A couple of them were deacons, that kind of thing. I think in part because I have every confidence that there was no reason for him not to be there. In fact, he had a great ministry to the church as a whole, but especially to those folks who felt disenfranchised, which would not have happened no matter how much I tried and other people tried, would not have happened, I don't think, without that situation being there. So I was and still am thoroughly convinced that was where, and those were decisions that needed to be made, and that's where he needed to be, and that God did not punish that remarriage or that divorce, but rather used it.
He was already in that particular instance you're talking about. He was biblically released from that divorce.
And that's what I'm saying. You've got this verse here that says, no, or in Matthew, except for unchastity, bouncing off Paul, who actually has more to do with the Christian church and how it functions anyway than Jesus does in his teachings. I mean, if you look on any given Sunday, except for around Christmas and Easter, if you were to go through Christendom as a whole, I think, and look at the passages that are preached from in the New Testament, you will find many more that come from Paul than they do from the Gospels. But Paul says, wait a minute, there may be some other extenuating circumstances out here, and you may not be bound to that. So I understand your difficulty, and I understand the dilemma there in making the decision. But I think given you look at circumstances and situations and you deal with them, case by case, not carte blanche either way.
You know, I guess I speak up on this right here. I've probably one of you in the host church. It has been divorced and remarried. I'll be the first to tell you. My first situation was the same. She ran off another person and all that.
Yeah.
After I met Cindy, before I asked Cindy to marry me, I come talk to Dr. Benny about how he felt about it. He told me before my kids, Junior, what he called me, he said, I know you probably know your situation for you. He said, there was, he said, your stepfather was working all the time. This is, I don't think this Lord King has lived the rest of your life like Seth across his situation. So in my days, you may ask him about that. And we've been married, we've been 37 years now, you know. So I just feel like, I've done everything I could, but, you know, if I'm living the sin,
Yeah, I don't think you are.
I think his Bible's very clear. You won't get me to ever judge that. Because it says that's not my job. God relieves me from that. Yeah. He says, I'll take care of judgments. And you don't have to
judge
it. So you don't have to worry about that for me.
And
the thing that I think, you know, a lot of times we get upset about, but God says he's the judge. And that releases the rest of us in church from having burden other people with our judgments, hopefully.
Oh, but how many people actually let it go in church?
I honestly would not judge Junior.
No, you wouldn't, but how many? There are plenty of places and plenty of people who will.
If you're truly a Christian and you truly study the Bible, then you know that's not your place. That God didn't call you to do that. He didn't call me to judge
you. You know, I've got like 3 years ago that I did. And before I am 78, I come talk to Dr. Ernest how he would feel about situation, my situation. I would like to tell you this.
Ed?
When we were on our last search committee, and you were the product all the time. we're getting a lot of things, and I had one that I was looking at, and I called it a reference. And the reference was down at Myrtle Beach, a real nice-sounding guy, and he said, but I'm going to tell you, he says, so-and-so has been divorced. And I said, and I'm thinking to myself, well, our church was a lot of old people back then set in the fundamental ways and everything else. I could handle it, you know, if we'd got to the delving of it and everything else. He said he's a good man, but his wife just woke up one day and said, I don't want to be married to a preacher, just left. Now, that was it on the surface.
Yeah.
And with us coming up on this new search committee and everything else, I think we're going to have to do a lot more deepening and more delving under the circumstances of the way's lifestyle and see exactly what happens instead of just nap or something like that, you know.
Yes.
You
Susan.
Were in Sunday school this morning, were you? No. I missed you.
And you missed a lot of food.
I feel a lot better now.
Okay. But what I was going to say is we made the announcement for the first time this morning. And what the announcement was this. The pastor search committee is prayerfully seeking input from every church.
Yeah.
We're going to do a survey. We're going to put one together to create a pastor profile. But before we create the pastor profile and create the survey, before that, we sincerely ask people to let us know either in writing or just face-to-face, any member of the committee, or if you don't feel comfortable doing that, write it down, put it anonymously in a note, type it up, give it to Kim, and tell Kim this is for the search committee. Because we know the world has changed. And we know the congregation dynamic has changed. Okay. Steve's been here 14 years.
14 and a half.
Yeah. So for that many years ago, this is what the world has done.
You're almost a generation.
I agree with you. It's a whole other thing we have to think about. So if that's a concern, put it on a piece of paper and let us know. So sure to ask
questions. I think it's a lessening concern in itself. But like I said, anything's going to deserve digging.
It does. But it's also interesting to note here that in Mark's version, remarriage is worse than divorce. According to this, remarriage is worse than divorce. Not too sure about that, but.
It's very sad to see this. But I have known people who really took that verse.
Right.
Absolutely literally.
Well, I know.
Left the rest of their life, never having the companionship and love of a spouse.
And to
me,
it is. Well, if you
believe this so strong.
Yeah. Well, it's just like the snake handlers believe if you don't believe you can handle snakes and let them bite and drink poison, you don't believe anything in the Bible either. But even though that's not in the oldest versions. But it's also interesting to know this is contrary. Josephus writes, and I quote, "For it is only the man who is permitted by us to do this," that's dissolve a marriage, "and not even a divorced woman may marry again on her own initiative unless her former husband consents." End of quote. So that was the way their society was set up. Even if it was a bad marriage and you know, you divorced her and then later she finds somebody who wants to get married, she has to come to you, the former, and get permission to marry. In the way Judaism was set up at that point in time. Yes.
In God's eyes, what consummates marriage? The coming together of a man and woman. So just because you got a piece of paper saying you're married, a lot of people have been in relationships with other people that aren't married, so you could go there, and a lot of people hold up their piece of paper, you know, well, I haven't never been married,
well,
a lot of people have been with her.
But I tell folks, you know, actually marriage ceremony didn't show up for a long, long time. In the Old Testament, if you spent the night with somebody, you were married. And if we did that today, there'd be a whole lot of polygamists in the world. But, you know, and so here, you know, Jesus still holds up the ideal, but Edvard Schweizer writes, interestingly enough, and I quote, "Divorce can be a sign of repentance by which two people face up to their failure. It can be a confession that they have not succeeded in living according to God's desire, that is, on the basis of His gift. Divorce can, therefore, set one free to experience anew the mercy of God. On the other hand, the preservation of the outward appearance of a marriage which has actually been destroyed can blur the consciousness of guilt and failure. What this means in practice is that the marriage of a divorced person cannot be forbidden in a rigid legalism, nor can divorce proceedings be started indiscriminately." End of quote. And that's what Jesus is saying here. You don't do it indiscriminately. It's a serious matter, and you don't do it indiscriminately. And actually, it can be a means of coming to God and being reconciled with God. Of course, Schweizer's a Lutheran German minister, but very brilliant man. I have 3 or 4 of his commentary books. I don't think he's alive anymore. A lot of times they're not. One of the most poignant movies that I ever saw was Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep, Kramer versus Kramer. Well, that one will do it. And the 3 other movies that I tell people you should see sometime in your life. One True Thing, Meryl Streep, Renee Zellweger, William Hurt, and when that one's over with, you'll either go call your mama or you'll say prayers and ask God to pass them on to your mama. Life as a House. Life as a House. You'll go call your daddy or you'll pray to God and say, please give this message to my daddy. And then, of course, the bucket list. But I'd have to add Kramer versus Kramer as a 4. Well, and when, as Paul, like I said, I think when Paul says, and I told the congregation at Hope Memorial when they asked, I said, you know, for God has called us to peace. If the marriage has become a war zone, and it's nothing but a war zone, and it's dangerous, staying in that may very well be worse than dissolving it.
Yeah, that's the thing I hear your brother about having kids. Sometimes it's better to be with one parent than have two together.
And all of these, in other words, the Bible lets us know life is sticky. Life is messy. Life is difficult. And the only way to truly live holy, that's W-H-O-L-L-Y, is within God's grace and not only getting it for ourselves, but being willing to dispense it as well. And therein is the rub far too often, is our unwillingness to give it up once we get it.
We do these things in God's plan. Of course, we wouldn't be making the most thing. I was counseling with a couple today, and I'm like, you know, you're in this situation because you didn't do it God's way.
Right.
So we're talking about how we're going to do it God's way, and you're in this position with children estranged over here and over here because you didn't.
But it's
a perfect plan if we followed God's perfect plan, which all and none of us do, of course. But if we did follow God's perfect plan, He set it forth in order in a strict direction to where two men come together as one, and we leave our wives, our mothers, our fathers, and we become as one flesh. And if we do it that way, my brother right here, he's fixing to get married, and that's why they're going to have to do it. They're coming together like that. And they put God first, and then those things wouldn't.
But then again, you know, and it's not an excuse in our humanity. We make our own choices, and oftentimes they're bad. But then again, God set that up in the beginning and said, I'm going to give you the ability to choose. In other words, why put the tree in there and why say, hey, don't?
Well, and that brings to mind Psalm 51, where David, a man after God's own heart, who certainly messed up.
He did.
And was a murderer and an adulterer. He said, created me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me.
Yeah.
Against you and you only have I sinned.
Right.
And now I want to make it right, basically. And I think whenever I think about people or situations like that, I think that's what God's looking for, the heart part.
Yeah, I think the heart part is, and when we sin against anyone else, we've ultimately sinned against God because they're God's creation as well.
God took the baby away. He killed the baby.
Yeah, that's part of the whole idea of corporate personality.
Okay, so sometimes when people look at this, they'll say, well, why should he take the baby away? Why didn't he take David away or Bathsheba and let the baby live? There's so many other ways that people think that we don't even consider it. Because to me, the way God was talking to David, this is your crime, not mine, and I'm going to take the baby away.
And we don't know.
Not bad. That's good, because the consequences of God is very severe.
Yes, sir.
And we don't want to think about that.
Nope.
But we better start thinking that God can take
always.
Well, look at Job.
And how he wants.
Yeah.
And it could be a lot of horrible things, and we don't want to think about that.
Nope.
But God can do that.
God can, but they're also, at the same time, Ariel, at the same time, God can do that, but there are a lot of things that we do that we give God or the devil a blame when neither one of them had anything to do with it because we did it. But,
well, that's true.
But
I think basically we know what we're getting most of the time. We just don't want to face up to it.
No, we don't, and we don't want to think about it. Thank y'all. This has been good. But the choir rehearses in a few minutes, and we need to wrap it up. God bless you. Yes, y'all can stay for choir practice. But be careful tonight, and be careful in the cold. God bless you. Go in peace. Don't forget the funeral Tuesday if you can make it. Amen. Three. Time to rebel with or without a cause.